29 years ago today, I was putting on my tuxedo, getting ready to marry my bride. 29 years ago. Can you believe that? Yep. And my wife's parents were at their house trying to convince her to go through with it. And I did the math. 29 years. Anybody know how many hours that is? That's 10,585 hours. And I've done the math over these 10,585 hours, and I estimate that I have spent about 8 to 10,000 of those hours waiting for Christina. Just a little bit here and there, 5 minutes here, 10 minutes, 20 minutes sometimes, waiting for her to be ready to go somewhere, waiting for her so we could restart the movie we were watching, waiting for her to get out of the bathroom so I get a turn. The more I think about it, the number's probably higher than that. That's 8 to 10,000. That's about a whole year worth of waiting. And she's worth it, obviously. But sometimes I try to outsmart her. Sometimes I don't get all the way ready. And then I'll just kind of do something else. And then when she's ready, I'm like, oh, wait, I have to do one more thing. And then I'll go do my one more thing. And she'll be like, okay, no problem. And then when I'm ready, I'm like, okay, let's go now. And she's like, oh, wait, I have to do one more thing. She's diabolical about this. And it's never on purpose, but it always happens. Waiting isn't fun, is it? It's a pain to wait. But waiting is a fact of life. And instead of trying to eliminate waiting from your life, which you can't do, we might do better to learn instead how to wait well. That's certainly true when it comes to waiting for Jesus and his return and the bringing of his kingdom once and for all, putting an end to this age with all of its turmoil and trouble. And with everything happening in the world around us right now, more and more people are talking about when Jesus is going to return. It happens every time the world strains under the pains of war, especially when that it involves Israel. Is this it? Is this the time? Is this the when that we've been waiting for? And people desperately try to link what the Bible says to the specifics of our situation and figure out, is this the when? When? When is the wrong question? We always ask the wrong questions. When we read the beginning of the Bible in Genesis, we ask the wrong questions. We ask how, when Genesis is clearly trying to answer who and why. A loving God created us so he could be with us and we could be with him. We did a whole series on that. And then we come to the other side of the Bible. We're obsessed with when. And Jesus clearly told us over and over again that we can't know and won't know when. Jesus was much more interested in another question. How? As in, how will you wait? And this morning, in our last Sunday of Missions Month, I want to look at what Jesus said about the end of this age and the beginning of the next. And I want to show you that Jesus told us not to worry about the when, but instead to spend time, he spent most of his time telling us how to wait. And we're going to cover a lot of ground today. I'm going to go quickly. Instead of focusing on just one paragraph and diving deep, we're going to cover two chapters, Matthew 24 and 25, and I am going to go fast. I'm going to try and give you an overview of these chapters so you can see the large argument that Jesus is making and what he said about the end of the age and the five ways you and I need to wait for the entrance of the age to come. So you go to Matthew chapter 24, and I invite you, I'm not going to put many verses on the screen today. Follow along in our app. If you don't have our app, you can go to YouVersion, and you can search Freedom Hill, and you'll find the notes there too. But follow along there. You'll have the scriptures, or open your own Bible to Matthew chapter 24. And here's what's happening as we're in the beginning. Jesus and his disciples are in the temple in Jerusalem, and they start to leave, and they start to walk out of the temple compound, and the disciples These are country boys, and they're amazed at the big city buildings. They're just astounded at the beauty of the temple compound and everything, and they start commenting on it, and Jesus just quietly makes this comment and says, the day is coming when not a single one of these stones will stand on top of the other. And they're like, what? But no one asked them then, because that was a pretty dangerous thing to say in the middle of Jerusalem. So they wait. They wait until they get outside of Jerusalem and go across the Kidron Valley and over to the Mount of Olives, kind of like it would be to walk from here over to Overlook Ridge, across the highway. And once they're there and no one else is around, the disciples, sensing, okay, this was a comment about Jesus is about to do the thing. Jesus is about to bring his kingdom. And they ask him, in verse 3 of chapter 24, tell us, when will this happen, and what will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age? And Jesus responded to their question by telling them what they could expect. And it's important to understand that the words Jesus says here in chapter 24, especially this first beginning here, they have direct fulfillment in the days and weeks and months that follow Jesus saying that. But they also give us a pattern of truths that echoes and reverberates into the future, into the end of this age. That's how prophecy almost always works. It has immediate fulfillment, but points to future fulfillment. And I want to try and summarize Jesus' points to them from these first half of chapter 24, the first 30 verses or so. The first point Jesus makes to them is there will be a lot of people out there making a lot of false claims, and there'll be a lot of false signs. Bad things will happen to you and around you, and these are just the beginning of birth pains. You know how when a mom is about to give birth, but maybe it isn't time yet. We've got a couple pregnant moms to be in the room right now. And sometimes you get those pains and you're like, is it the time? But it's just a beginning pain. It's not quite yet. And Jesus says that's what those are. But a lot of these things will happen. He says, don't be deceived and get caught up every time something happens. They're not necessarily the time of the birth of the new age. The second point he makes to them, he says, those who follow Jesus are going to have trouble, but the good news of Jesus' kingdom is going to be preached to the world. As a testimony to the world, it won't be stopped. The third point he makes to them is the trouble that you go through will make you desperate to know the when. So desperate that many people will be deceived constantly into thinking, oh, now's the time, oh, now's the time, oh, now's the time. A mother just recently, a couple days ago, kidnapped her 16-year-old son, took him into the woods, they think maybe up into Canada, because she thinks he is pivotal in the coming of Christ. And she thinks he's a figure, maybe even the messianic figure. She became so obsessed with all of this that she's now kidnapped her son. Don't let that happen to you, Jesus says. Jesus says his entrance will be unmistakable. He says it'll be like lightning filling the sky. Have you ever been in a lightning storm? Even if your eyes are closed, you know lightning just flashed, don't you? It's like traffic. If you see all the cars, where all the cars were all piled up, you know that's where the accident happened. It's clear, it's obvious, Jesus says, when I come, when it's the time of my coming, it will be clear. And then Jesus says at the end of all this, verse 36, but about that day or hour, no one knows, not even the angels of heaven nor the Son, but only the Father. And then Jesus proceeds to spend the rest of chapter 4 and all of chapter 25 not talking about when, but talking about how to wait, because how to wait is what's most important. You don't know when. Don't obsess about when or fall victim to those who do. Instead, Jesus says, this is how you should wait. First way, wait expectantly, Jesus says. Wait in such a way that you're not surprised when Jesus shows up and enters in this new age. And he says this, verse 37, as it was in the days of Noah, so it will be at the coming of the Son of Man. And a lot of people say, yep, it's bad, just like it was in Noah's day. It's going to be bad right before Jesus comes. And look, it's bad. That's not the analogy he's drawing. He's not saying just like it was bad in Noah's day. He's saying something else. He says, just like in Noah's day, here's what's going to be going on. In the days before the flood, people were eating and drinking and marrying and giving in marriage. They were going about with normal life, unaware of anything that might be coming. Up to the day Noah entered the ark, and they knew nothing about what would happen until the flood came and took them all away. This is how it will be at the coming of the Son of Man. Two men will be in the field. One will be taken, the other left. Two women will be grinding at the handmill. One will be taken, the other left. Therefore, keep watch, because you do not know on what day your Lord will come. But understand this, if the owner of the house had known at what time of night the thief was coming, he would have kept watch and would not have let his house be broken into. So you also must be ready, because the Son of Man will come at an hour when you don't expect him. In the days of Noah, everyone was going about life as normal, all doing whatever you do in life. And Jesus compares that to this day when he returns and ushers in his kingdom. And he says, there'll be people just going to work like normal. Two guys out at work, one's taken, the other's left. Two women doing housework together, one's taken, the other's left. And by the way, we always think taken, yeah, they get to go away and to a good place. But if it's a context of a flood, and we're both standing here and a flood comes, and it takes me and leaves you, who's in the better position? Not the one taken. The flood got me. Understand what Jesus is trying to say here. He then goes on about being ready for a thief. The whole point Jesus is making is this. Live your life in a way that you won't be surprised when Jesus returns. And that means that we should always have in mind this new life that we long for, this new kingdom, this new age that we long for. It should always be in our minds, so much so that we're already living according to it now. So that we're not surprised all of a sudden, no, we're not ready for it. Because it's easy to forget. It's easy to go about your day and do your work and do your things around your house and do all that stuff and have no constant awareness of the imminency of Christ. All my life I've heard people saying, and I'm 52, almost 53. All my life I've heard people say, Jesus is coming soon. 52, 53 years isn't soon, is it? Jesus is imminently coming. You'll never hear me say Jesus is coming soon because I don't know. But I know his coming is imminent, which means it could be any moment. That's what Jesus taught us. Think about athletes when they're getting ready for a competition. What do? They stretch their muscles, they warm them up, they warm up their joints so that when the whistle blows, they can move and be ready to go. So just as warming up before a workout or a competition gets your muscles and joints ready, living the way of this kingdom we long for warms us up and we're ready to go. It won't be a shock, we'll be ready. Wait expectantly. Don't ever lose that sense of expectation. It's so easy to do. The second thing Jesus says is wait accountably. And he said, know that we're going to give an account for what we have done and not done on that day. Verse 45, and this is the last part I'm going to read. The rest we're going to have to summarize. He says, who then is the faithful and wise servant whom the master has put in charge of the servants in his household to give them their food at the proper time? It will be good for that servant whose master finds him doing what he's supposed to be doing, taking care of everyone in the home. Truly, I tell you, if he finds him doing that, he'll put him in charge of all his possessions. But suppose that servant is wicked and says, you know, my master's taking a long time, and then begins to think it's all his and begin to beat his fellow servants and eat and drink with drunkards. The master of that servant will come on a day when he does not expect him, and in an hour he's not aware of, you should always be expecting, and he will cut him to pieces and assign him a place with the hypocrites where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Wait in such a way that you know you and I are going to be accountable for how we spend every minute of our time, every ounce of our energy, every penny in our wallets, every bit of our resources, and most of all, accountable for how we've treated others. Wait expectantly. Wait accountably. This is a whole sermon series, I know, but I think you got the point there. The third one is wait perseveringly. Jesus next tells the parable about a wedding and some wise and foolish bridesmaids. A lot of you know this story. Some of them are ready, some of them aren't. Some of them have enough oil in their lamps to keep them burning. The others did not. And in this story, we all like to dissect it and try and figure out all the pieces and what they mean. The most important verse in this story about the five wise and the five foolish bridesmaids is verse 5 of chapter Matthew 25. And it says this, the bridegroom was a long time in coming. There was delay. That's the main point of that parable. There was delay. And Jesus' entrance into this world to bring in the end of this age and the beginning of the next will not come as quickly as you want it to. That was true in the early church. It's true today. What's important is how we wait. Waiting tests our ability to persevere. Half of the bridesmaids in that story were not ready to persevere. The other half were. So the ones who were ready and persevered, they got to go in. The ones who didn't were left out. Be ready to persevere. Wait with perseverance, not with desperation. I see desperation all around us today. I see desperation on the internet. I hear desperation in some of your voices. Don't run to this website and that website or this preacher and that preacher until you find someone who looks like they've figured out all the connections and how it's all going to work, and now they know when it's all going to happen. No, that'll only make it harder to persevere every time you're disappointed. Instead, wait expectantly, wait accountably, wait with a perseverance that endures the delay. The Bible assures us God isn't being lazy, God isn't being slow. God's delay is so that more people will come to know him. Fourth thing he teaches us, Jesus says, wait productively. He tells a parable about a man who has three servants. You all know this story too. The man's about to leave on a trip, but before he goes, he calls in his three servants. He gives one of them 5 bags of gold. He gives the second servant 2 bags of gold, and to the other servant, he gives 1 bag of gold. Each one gets according to their ability, according to what he believed they could handle and be responsible for. Fast forward, a long time goes by. The man comes home, and the two servants who got 5 bags and 2 bags, they come up to him, and they've both doubled. They've served him well. They've been faithful, and they've worked with what he gave them. And he says, great job, and he rewards them. He's so happy with what they've done. But then the third servant comes and hands him a dirty bag of gold. He had buried it. And so the man fired him and kicked him out of the house. And some people read that story, and they feel sorry for that servant. After all he did was try and protect the gold and make sure nothing happened to him. Was it really so awful to bury it and keep it safe? But that would be missing the point. Don't get confused here. The point of this story is not that he kept the money safe. It's that he refused to serve. That's the point. The master expected faithful service, and he rewarded the two who gave faithful service, not because they made so much. That's not what he was concerned about. They faithfully served, so he rewarded them and blessed them. And he punished the one who robbed him of the service he was owed. We have no right to withhold our service from God. Jesus tells us. God expects you and I to faithfully, productively wait. You and I don't have control over what God's given each one of us. There's no point in you and I comparing how much each one of us has. That's not the comparison. The standard is this. Not how much we're given, not how much we produce. It's whether we faithfully served. Are we faithfully serving? That's the measure. That's how to wait. Are you waiting in a way that's being productive for God's kingdom, expectant, accountable? Are you waiting in a way that perseveres? And now the fifth way, and this is the one I wanted to spend a good focus on here, a good chunk of time to focus. So we're going to read this whole parable Jesus tells. It's the parable of the sheep and the goats. A lot of you know this. This is a scary story. Jesus says, when the Son of Man comes in his glory and all the angels with him, he will sit on his glorious throne. All the nations will be gathered before him, and he will separate the people one from another as a shepherd would separate sheep from goats. And he will put the sheep on his right and the goats on his left. And then the king will say to those on his right, come, you who are blessed by my Father, take your inheritance, the kingdom prepared for you since the creation of the world. For I was hungry and you gave me something to eat. I was thirsty, you gave me something to drink. I was a stranger, you invited me in. I needed clothes, you clothed me. I was sick and you looked after me. I was in prison and you came to visit me. And the righteous will answer him. Do you remember what they say? Lord, When did we see you hungry and feed you, or thirsty and give you something to drink? When did we see you a stranger and invite you in, or needing clothes and clothe you? When did we see you sick or in prison and go to visit you? They're dumbfounded by this. And the king will reply and say, truly I tell you, whatever you did for one of the least of these my brothers and sisters, you did for me. Then he will say to those on his left, depart from me, you who are cursed, into the eternal fire prepared for the devil and his angels. For I was hungry and you gave me nothing to eat. I was thirsty, you gave me nothing to drink. I was a stranger, you didn't invite me in. I needed clothes, you didn't clothe me. I was sick and in prison and you did not look after me. And they will also answer and say, Lord, when did we see you hungry or thirsty or a stranger or needing clothes or sick or in prison and not help you? And he'll reply, truly I tell you, whatever you did not do for one of the least of these you did not do for me. Then they will go away to eternal punishment, but the righteous to eternal life. First of all, first way we get this parable wrong, this is not about how you and I get into Jesus' kingdom when it's revealed. That wouldn't make sense, would it? Nothing Jesus does after telling the story would make any sense if this was how to get into God's kingdom. Because Jesus goes on from here and suffers and dies and overcomes death for our sin. He wouldn't have to do that if you and I could get into his kingdom by just being nice and being generous and sharing with people. Second of all, notice that both groups are surprised. Both groups are surprised. The sheep were surprised about all the loving things they did, they were doing to Jesus when they did them. They didn't know that. They didn't do them expecting, oh, this will get me points into God's kingdom. They did them because Jesus had transformed their character, their nature, and they were already living out the ways of God's kingdom expectantly, accountably, perseveringly, and productively. They were already doing it because they've been transformed by Jesus. The goats are shocked that by not caring about anyone else around them, they hadn't been caring for Jesus. But wait a minute, what about the songs we sang? Didn't they count? What about the time we spent in church? Or all the bad words I only thought but didn't actually say? Like, doesn't any of that count for anything, Jesus? This is not about how we enter God's kingdom. The second way we get this wrong, this is not about how we treat poor people. This is not saying if you want to make Jesus happy, then be nice to the poor. There are plenty of places in Scripture that talk about how we should be generous and care for those who are poor and hurting and broken. This is not one of them. Here, Jesus clearly says this is about what we do for the people he describes as his brothers and sisters. Well, who are they? There's a moment earlier in Matthew's gospel where Jesus' mother and brothers come to talk to him. They're a little concerned about him, and they can't get into him, and so the message gets through the crowd, and someone says to Jesus, hey, your mother and brothers are waiting outside. They want to talk to you. And Jesus replies and says this. He says, who is my mother, and who are my brothers? And then pointing to his disciples, he said, here are my mother and my brothers. For whoever does the will of my Father in heaven is my brother, my sister, and my mother. What did Jesus mean by that? He wasn't rejecting his family. He was making a point. Jesus considers everyone who serves God to be his family. And he identifies with us as his family. More than that, even Jesus identifies himself so closely with us that the way people treat those who are doing God's will and serving God's kingdom here and now, Jesus considers that how we're treating him. When Jesus confronted Saul, do you remember Saul, the guy who was killing Christians and persecuting them? He's on the road to Damascus to go hunt down and imprison some more Christians. What did Jesus say to Saul? Saul, Saul, why are you persecuting me? That's how Jesus sees it. Those who've been truly transformed by Jesus will be generous with those who suffer and serve Jesus' kingdom. They won't do it to earn their way into Jesus' kingdom. They'll do it unselfconsciously because they're being and have been transformed by Jesus. Jesus expects us to wait generously. Jesus expects us to have compassion on those who suffer for the sake of the gospel. Who better fits that description than our missionaries? These are modern-day apostles taking the good news about God's kingdom to the ends of the earth. They give up homes, secure jobs, family, friends, all to answer God's call. They don't have what you and I have. Sometimes they have to go hungry. Sometimes they go in need. Don't have the things they need to have. Don't have the things they wish their kids have, that our kids have. Sometimes their health suffers. Sometimes some of our missionaries have ended up in prison even. And Jesus tells us that how we wait is really important in waiting generously. Part of that is how we treat our missionaries is really important about how we wait. Wait expectantly, wait accountably, wait perseveringly, wait productively, and most of all, wait generously. Generous toward those who are suffering for the sake of the gospel, wherever you find them, here in our church and abroad. If anyone fits that category, it's certainly our missionaries. And the question for us is, are you in or are you out?
Hi, church. Don Vitera here from Indonesia. Just wanted to give you a little story and tell you kind of what's going on here in Indonesia. We are on the island of Bali. We are in the city of Denpasar. In Indonesia, it's a majority of Muslim people, but actually in Bali, it's a majority of Balinese Hindu. As a matter of fact, Hinduism here might even be older than the Hinduism in India. There's some reports of still studying that. But anyways, we're in a city of about 3 million people. There are Muslims, there are Hindus, there are Buddhists. There are people from all faiths here, from all different countries. And like I said, I think there's about 3 million people, if I'm not mistaken, here in Denpasar. So we came here a little over 10 years ago, and we began what we would call an international community. When we first came here, we didn't know anybody, but God was so gracious. We started one small group after another small group, and then we started a Sunday morning gathering in our community. And I honestly will tell you that over these years, right around 300 or so people that I have baptized on this island and other islands. And so we have grown our community here to, on Sunday mornings, we have somewhere around 500-600 people coming of all faiths, of all countries. It is the most international place I've ever been. It's so much fun. Sometimes even when we're sharing on Sunday mornings, I watch in the audience and someone will be actually whispering to someone else. What they're actually doing is translating into like Portuguese or Russian or Spanish. I mean, we watch this all the time. And so it's a lot of fun, actually. We're having a great time. So we grew this community with a purpose. And what we do is from this community, we do outreaches on this island and other islands. And what we do is we bring teams up into the villages and we do things like medical clinics. We do mommy baby. We do English programs, feeding programs, you name it. We do it. We'll do it, whatever the village needs. And we do that. We build relationships with them. And from there, we begin to start house churches in those villages. And currently, I think we're somewhere around 13 house churches. Our goal next year is to train at least close to 50 people. That's my goal, to start house churches all throughout this island and beyond. Now, in these different outreaches, as we get in there, we find people who are open to the gospel, and we just start going to their home, sharing the gospel. And we have seen, you know, many, many people come to Jesus. Just this past week, I led a Buddhist woman to Jesus. It was so much fun. And I want to kind of close by just telling you a story about someone, because this man, he just changed my life. When I was in another island, when I first came to Indonesia, I was on another island and I was studying the language, and I met this man, and he said he had a call of God on his life. So I said, well, if you follow me, we'll see what happens. And so he sold everything he had, which was only about $100 and stuff, and he came with me here to this island. I trained him up and we began to do some outreaches on another island. I can't really tell you the name. So we started doing outreaches on this other island, which was 100% Muslim villages. And we began to do outreaches there, and he kept coming with us, and he fell in love with this city, with this village, right? And when I say village, there's about 200,000 people. He fell in love with it, and miraculously, they invited him to come and live there. You can't just move there. You have to be invited. So he was basically the only Christian to be invited into this village. Since then, he continues to just serve them and help them with farming and finances. And God is just raising him up, kind of like Daniel. Now, several years ago, there was these huge earthquakes there. I mean, it devastated. There was no water, no electricity, no housing. All the houses, I mean, when I say earthquakes, we're talking big, probably some of the biggest in history they've had there. And so I was really nervous. So I called him up and I said, hey, we will bring your family down there, because he had two children and his wife. And I said, we'll send you down to the city. We'll put you up. We'll make sure you take care of until electricity and everything comes. And he says to me on the phone, he says, no, I can't leave now. This is my time to love these people. This is my time to show that Jesus loves them. And like, it kind of blew my mind that he would stay. And he stayed. He actually was severely injured while he was trying to help them get water, but he's fine now. And so he continues to do that. Well, only maybe a couple of months ago, I saw him, and he was on our island, we were talking. And after we got done talking about strategizing, as we were leaving, he turned to me and he said, Pastor Don, I've got to thank you. Thank you for what? He goes, thank you for letting me live my dream. And I'm thinking, live your dream. You live in a village where it's so hard. Sometimes there's no water. Sometimes the electricity goes out. All kinds of problems in this village, and in a place where people still haven't accepted him fully, because he's of another faith and they don't want to play with his kids because their children are a Christian. And yet He's telling me that he's living a dream and he's thanking me for doing it. I believe when we get to heaven, there will be people like him sitting on throne, and we will look at them and say, who are they? They are people who have sacrificed their lives for Jesus. And I just want to encourage you, sacrifice your love for Jesus. Give them all. Just go for it. Go lead someone to Jesus. Go love them so much that they want to come to the kingdom because you love them so much. I want to thank you for supporting us. Thank you for everything you do. God bless you guys. Go out and tell someone about Jesus.
You all remember Don from last year? I know Sebastian does. This morning, I want you to take out the cards that you got when you walked in. And if you didn't fill them out yet, don't do it yet. We're going to spend a moment and pray about it before we fill them out. Well, I just want to tell you, well, here's where we're at. First, we got a map, I think, just showing where we have missionaries around the world. So I know you can't read that, but you can get a sense for, we've got missionaries around the globe. You see a lot of people focused right around our area. That's because we have made a conscious investment, in particular in the colleges around Massachusetts. So that's why there's a lot of college investment here. But then around the world, we've got people. You see the one in the middle of America, that's Christina Deere from our own church, who travels around the world doing engineering projects to help people and share the gospel. So that gives you a picture of them. Then just another thing I'm thinking of, this past week, just so you get a feel for what we were able to do, I was talking to a missionary who's, I won't tell you their names, I'll tell you where they are. They're in the Comoros Islands, again, a place that is a sensitive region, so we're not allowed to like put their names with their place. And they have a school building they needed help fixing. They have no water, and they also had no furniture. And our church bought them what they needed to get water and furniture this past week. They are in a place where the people that they're among have no written form of their language. And they are doing the work of creating a written language for these people so that, and they're doing it by translating the Bible. So they're creating the written language, and the very first book they'll have is the Bible. So we invested in that project because of the giving of our church family here. And he also had mentioned they had a few churches had to drop them, and so they were short on their monthly support. We, because of all your giving, our giving, were able to say, you know what, we'll cover that amount that those other churches left a void, and we'll take care of that for you. And so we took them on this week because of our giving. So far for this year, we had pledged, this means last year when people filled these out, they promised 50,000, which was, for the last few years since COVID, the amount we've promised has been 10,000 or more less than what we used to promise. Interestingly enough, our giving has still been the same or better. So we've already reached our promise. Our promise was 50. We've already given 49. We're probably at 50 by now. We've already met our promise for this year. Our goal for this year is to get to 70, and we've got a few more months to do that, and I know we can. So today, in a minute, I'm asking you to give an offering. That's all this offering is going straight to our missionaries. So that's what this offering is going to be. If you need to catch up on your promise for this year, use this chance to do that. If you just want to give an extra amount just to help us get to that 70 for missionaries, do that now. But also, I want you to pray about and think about filling this card out if you didn't already. Make a commitment to give for next year. What will it be? Each month, it could be weekly, it could be a one-time lump sum. Ask God to show you. I can't show you, and I'm not going to twist your arm. I've made the case. It's part of how Jesus expects us to wait, and I think that's what we need to take to heart today. And so let's just take a moment, and let's pray. And then fill out that card. If you've already done it online, maybe fill it out again. Let God talk to you. Father, I pray that our giving would always be a response to you, to what you've done, to who you are, because our hearts just long to see people know you and enter into the freedom, the rescue from sin, and know what it means to really live in you. So, Lord, I pray that our promises for next year and our giving now would reflect all of that. And Lord, I pray that as we give, we'd remember what you called us to do, how you called us to wait, and that we'd be those kinds of people, I pray in your name. Amen.